from the fully composted studios of WDIY in Bethlehem, PA. It is time for another Organic Hour, a chemical-free horticultural hijinks. You bet your garden. You already know that you should grow in raised beds, but do you know what to fill those beds with? I'm Mike McGrath, and on today's show, we'll review the proper soil mix for making your plants prosper. Plus, a heaping helping of your fabulous phone call questions, comments, tips, tricks, suggestions, and respectfully redundant repudiations. So stay right where you are, cats and kittens. It's all coming up like a record number of terrific tomatoes because you provided them with Titanic soil.
WDIY presents a selection of award-winning podcasts that air weeknights from 6 to 7 p.m. Listen to important conversations regarding art, science, business, health, and more here in the Lehigh Valley and beyond. Check our website for new topics and archived programs. WDIY podcasts are on 88.1 FM, streaming at wdiy.org, on the app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
From the sun-soaked studios of WDIY FM in Bethlehem, PA, it is time for another Mediterranean hour of chemical-free horticultural hijinks, you bet your garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and in this week's edition of In the News, we are delighted to share some of the amazingly helpful information that pharmacists Joe and Teresa Graydon have been researching and revealing for many decades in print via their newspaper column distributed by King Features Syndicate, online at their website, and via their exceptional podcast. It's all under the name The People's Pharmacy. And their work in every form gets my highest recommendation. We now present a sample from their newspaper column as this week's edition of In the News, which we are calling Herbs Boost a Value of a Mediterranean Diet. The People's Pharmacy format is Q&A, and we will present this installment as such. Question: I keep reading that we should be following a Mediterranean diet for good health. It's full of vegetables and fruits, but what else? I'd like to know more about the effects of herbs like oregano, rosemary, and thyme. I'm cooking with olive oil instead of canola, but I would like some guidance on the spices. Answer: we suspect that the generous use of herbs contributes to the value of a Mediterranean diet. Rosemary, for example, is associated with better concentration and memory, as well as lower levels of anxiety and stress. Research indicates that rosemary also helps elderly people with diabetes sleep better than lavender aromatherapy. The ancient Greeks used oregano medicinally for respiratory and digestive problems. A review of recent research confirms that oregano can improve levels of cholesterol, HDL, and LDL. And scientists have established that thyme has broad-ranging antimicrobial properties, as well as antioxidant, anti-inflammatory, and cancer-fighting effects. There are a number of advantages to following a Mediterranean diet. In the most recent analysis of the long-running Nurses' Health Study, more than 10,000 middle-aged women were evaluated after 15 years. The nurses who followed a Mediterranean diet by consuming more vegetables, fruits, legumes, whole grains, fish, olive oil, and moderate amounts of alcohol fared best. They were less likely to develop chronic health problems, such as forgetfulness, breathing difficulties, Parkinson's disease, or cancer as they aged. And they lived longer. A Mediterranean diet was associated with both improved quality and quantity of life. Some years ago, a study also suggested that the benefits of a Mediterranean diet include a lower risk of arthritis. Nearly 5,000 Americans at high risk of osteoarthritis of the knee were recruited, and their eating patterns were analyzed by British and Italian scientists who assigned each volunteer a score to reflect their adherence to a Mediterranean diet. Those who had the highest scores on the questionnaire reported a substantially better quality of life, decreased arthritis pain and disability, and fewer depressive symptoms. The authors concluded that a Mediterranean diet may indeed lead to healthier aging.
Spread the word about your business or organization to a well-informed audience. Become an underwriter with WDIY. Our lineup of NPR News and locally produced programs reaches thousands of engaged listeners in the Lehigh Valley and beyond. Underwriting on WDIY is an affordable and effective way to provide information about your product and services to people who care. To learn more about underwriting opportunities, 610-694-8100 or WDIY.org.
Welcome back to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY FM in Bethlehem, PA. I am your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, what do I fill my raised beds with? Well, we'll tell you after more of your fabulous phone calls. 610-694-8100. Ruth, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thanks, Mike. Hi.
So what's your location?
I'm in Lawrence Township, New Jersey, and that's in Jersey.
Oh, yeah. No, it's next door to Princeton. What can we do for you today, Ruth?
Well, Mike, I had heard actually on your Facebook page that people were talking about having chickens in their yards. And I feel some concern because there's this, you know, the news of the avian flu going around. And I'm just wondering how that plays together.
Yes. The reason probably it was on the Facebook page is a couple of shows ago, I did a bit on, is this the year you should have backyard chickens, based on the fact, simply back then, of the rising egg prices. I wanted to warn people that there's a lot of responsibility involved, but with the price of eggs and the possibility of them becoming more expensive and these store scares. I've gone into supermarkets where there are no eggs. And
right.
So a lot of people who've been on the fence about this may have already been considering it. So I went over some of the details that if you're just coming at it blind, you wouldn't think about, like protecting them while they're outside from hawks and foxes, while still letting them pasture, roam, things like that. And at the very end, I did address bird flu, but the research that I found, even after the article appeared, people sent me articles saying I should have been more careful or this or that. And the articles about bird flu that even mentioned backyard chickens were about keeping them away from wild birds.
Ah.
And the biggest danger was that if you have an outdoor cat or a dog and you see it with a wild bird in its mouth, you've immediately got to glove up, put on protective gear, and get the animal to the vet, and if possible, the bird, so it can be tested. Because that's the transmission pattern right now. It's coming from wild birds. As people know, huge millions of chickens have had to be culled when they're on a big processing or raising area when one bird is found to have the flu. But you got to remember, these are, you know, hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of birds in one giant enclosure. And because people want to know that the chickens they're buying eggs from, ooh, now there's an image. Chicken coming to your door, knocking on the door. You want any eggs today?
Oh, my goodness.
Hey, I'll lay one fresh for you for a dollar. But they would have outdoor enclosures. You know, the chickens could leave the giant coop and go outside into steel runs where they were protected again from foxes and raptors. And apparently while they, you know, when they eat, when they free range, when they scratch up the dirt looking for bugs and weed seeds and sometimes little pebbles because they need those for reasons that I don't understand, but I believe it. If a wild bird has pooped there.
Through the slats, right? Right through the slats of the iron, of the enclosure, probably.
Right. It'll stop a hawk, but it won't stop poop. And that's how it gets back into the whole, quote, hen house. And then it's a disaster. And in many areas, including yours and mine, we have the noxious non-migrating Canada geese. These are not migrating Canada geese. Migrating Canada geese don't hang around, and they're protected by international law. But the ones we have just ruining an area near a lake or a park or anything like that, these were hunters' decoys, live decoys, that were released in around 1930 when the government made it illegal to use live decoys. The hunters just turned them loose, and they had lost the urge to migrate, and so they hang around and they make a dirty mess out of people's lawns and parks and stuff. So there is a lot of the transmission material out there. And the warning that I had, even when I wrote the original article, was, you know, again, don't let your pets come into contact with wild birds. If they do, call your veterinarian and see what you should do. Look, you know, for instance, if wild geese come down to your area, make sure you don't put the chicken run anywhere near where they've impacted, because you can't block the top of the run or they wouldn't get the sun that they're out there for. So, you know, that's the danger. The danger is not in the backyard chickens themselves. The danger is it infiltrating from wild birds to birds that are being used for mass egg production, and families who have a dog or a cat who impacts the wild birds. The cats, of course, will pick them up in their mouth and you bring them home alive to let them loose in the house for entertainment. But dogs, unfortunately, will eat anything, and they can pick it up very easy. The strain of this virus, the main vector, is wild birds. Not, oddly enough, the hens that are raising eggs. They're the victims.
So, Mike, What about foxes? Say a fox gets in your hen house. I mean, if it doesn't just cart the chicken away, could it infect any of your remaining chickens?
Well, if a fox gets in your hen house, you failed.
Right.
One thing I talked about is you have to construct a coop that is varmint-proof. And you need an outdoor run that is hawk-proof. I've seen hawks take chickens. Now, one alternative to that, if you want them to be more free-roaming, is have a rooster or two in the pack. You know, they're going to wake up your neighbors and such, and maybe you, and they can be really feisty because that's their job. But I have seen roosters battle red-tailed hawks and win. You know, that's their job, is to protect the flock. But again, the one thing I did not mention in the article that someone wrote in about that I just slapped my head and said, oh my God, you're right, was check your local regulations. A lot of places.
Right. My town doesn't allow roosters. And if you have rooster chicks, they have to be separated out after 3 months.
Yeah, well, that's done in the industry as well. But I love the distinction you just made. Some municipalities will not let you have backyard chickens at all, and some will let you have chickens, but no roosters because of the annoyance factor. So if I were a younger man, I've always, like said, backyard chickens, that's for next year. But by the time next year comes, there's another next year waiting. So I never had to do it. So that's the skinny, is backyard chickens are not going to spread the virus. They can catch the virus from wild birds and from animals that have had encounters with wild bird or consumed their feces. So, and that's important for people who don't even care about backyard chickens. If they have a dog and a cat, they have to be aware that that transmission works very easily. And of course, if you see a bird in distress or a possibly dead bird in your backyard, don't go out and pick it up. Call the vet. Call your local authorities. Call Superman. I don't care, but don't deal with it yourself.
Okay, good to know.
All right, Ruth?
Yeah, thanks, Mike. That helps a lot. I've always wanted chickens. It's still a dream, but that's good to know. Thank you.
It's very rewarding. It's a lot of work and responsibility, but I have never met a chicken farmer who wasn't happy. All right. Well, thank you for helping me clear this up. We can't talk about this enough. But bye for now. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and urge everybody out there who is currently enduring a freezing winter to avoid rock salt, aka sodium chloride, as it wreaks havoc on plants, concrete, cars, and all of the wonderful overwintering creatures we're supposed to love. But don't go looking for environmentally safe calcium chloride just yet, because we'll be right back to talk about the best dirt for your beds and take more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA.
Do you have vinyl albums, 45s, or CDs on your shelves that are taking up space and gathering dust? Why not donate them for a good cause? WDIY will receive profits from the donation, and you can claim a tax deduction. For more information, or to arrange for a drop-off or pickup, call 610-694-8100 or visit WDIY.org.
Welcome back to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA. I am your host, Mike McGrath. And coming up later in the show, a perennial. Get it? You know, perennial? Nah, forget about it. A perennial question, which is, what do I fill my raised beds with? Should it be topsoil? Should it be compost? Should it be mushroom soil? Should it be this curious thing called perlite you always talk about? Well, we'll tell you exactly what we think you should use after more of your fabulous phone calls at 610-694-8100. Paula, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you for taking my call.
Well, thank you for making it, Paula. How are you doing?
I am doing great here in Nashville, Tennessee.
Oh, it's always fabulous to hear from our listeners there. You have a very devoted gardening community in Nashville. It's a real, you ready for it? It's a real hotbed. Oh, thank you. Yeah, she actually said ha-ha. She couldn't. It's like a word balloon in a comic strip. Ha-ha. Thank you. And,
you're welcome.
Okay, so we've established that you're a wonderful person. You live in Nashville. What can we do you for?
Well, I would love to be able to compost my food scraps, keep them out of the landfill, and use the compost on my houseplants. But I live in a condo with only balcony access to the outdoors. And so a compost bin or a worm bin really aren't good options for me. So I'd appreciate your thoughts on alternatives that might work for my circumstances. I was really hoping to be able to put the food scraps maybe in something on my balcony and make sure the odor doesn't become a problem and just be able to do something different than a worm bin or, of course, one of those huge bins.
Well, this is a perfect time of year to remind people that we don't actually compost our food scraps. The majority of a typical compost pile is dry browns, especially shredded fall leaves, shredded dried corn stalks, straw, which means the seed heads have been cut off. That's the material, the bulk, that becomes compost. The food scraps we mix in provide food for the microorganisms that are already on, let's say, shredded leaves, and together they make compost. But there are now countertop composters that just utilize food waste. And
okay,
their boxes, maybe two toasters stacked on top of each other, that'd be the right kind of size. Inside is a bucket, and you fill the bucket with your food scraps as you go along. No meat, no bones, no citrus, really no bread or pasta or stuff like that. But you fill this with true wet greens, eggshells, coffee grounds, and of course, neither of those are green. That's why I started with them. Lettuce leaves, apple cores, broccoli stalks, cauliflower stalks, anything like that. The finished material is equal to worm castings. So what you do, you fill this thing up. Every day you put it back into the machine, which has a locking lid and a charcoal filter. So even if it takes you like a week to fill up the bucket, you won't get any smell, except, you know, for like 30 seconds when you're putting the fresh stuff in. So when the bucket is full, you turn the machine on, and it slowly, basically overnight, stirs and heats the material automatically for you, and when it's done, it'll ding or the light colors will change, you have super soil. Now, these machines are kind of expensive. Last time I checked, it was around $300. But as I say about a lot of things, you're going to amortize this, and they will last for many, many years. The company Vitamix makes one of them, and I have one of their super-powered blenders I got in the early 90s, and that thing works and looks brand new. They came out with the first one. I think it's called the Food Recycler. But shortly after that, other companies came out with them. If you don't want to throw away old bread or pasta or cake or anything like that, yeah, but see, but you'd get busted because it's an above-ground device called a green cone. You dig out a little ditch. You put the cone on top of it. You throw the rest of your food waste in there, and it slowly, naturally enters the soil. Not to feed anything necessarily, but to not throw it in the trash.
Okay.
Has your head exploded yet?
No, I really appreciate the information. That's great.
But I also urge people who have the room that worm bins do this for at least one-third of the price. They do not smell, because when you add garbage to a worm bin, you cover it with shredded newspaper. That's the only two contents, is the same kind of kitchen waste I just described and shredded newsprint. And I have left my worms alone, you know, feeding them first, making sure the moisture was right, for a month or more. And they do just fine. They're worms. They're eating food. You know, they're moving around. They're playing cards. They don't need you.
Okay.
But the choice is yours. And I think, based on the way you've described your situation, I think one of these on-the-counter food recyclers is perfect for you.
Okay, well, that's great. Again, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Oh, it's my pleasure. And anytime I answer a question like this, I'm getting the word out to so many other people. These things are not well known. So I'm really happy to talk about them and let people know they're out there. And I have one, and it works really well.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much. Thank you for all you do.
Well, thank you for listening and calling and pretending to laugh at my jokes.
Okay.
All right. Thank you, Paula. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
extension number 3. Steve, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Oh, I'm calling from Central Connecticut.
Oh, all right. That takes my next line out of the way. How you doing?
Everything's just donkey.
Very good. Thank you. And what can we do you for today?
I have 4 amaryllis bulbs that bloomed extremely well the first time, and then I put them out all summer and take them back in sometime in August after they've started to dry out. I put them in a paper bag, put them in the closet, and take them out, but I can't seem to get them to bloom again. What might I change doing?
Are the bulbs nice and firm and round and large?
Yes.
As opposed to shriveled and wrinkly in any way?
They're good and round and firm.
Okay.
Almost to the size of the pot that they're in.
Okay, good, good, good. And what stage are they at now? You know, do you know if there's any greenery emerging or anything like that?
Early February, I took out one, and it has sent up a lot of good green growth.
Okay.
The other are still dry in the closet.
Okay. And what are you doing with the green growth one?
About the only thing I'm doing is adding water.
Okay. Do you have it in the pot halfway down into a nice light seed starting mix, preferably with some added compost in a pot that drains well?
It's in the original packet of dried
soil.
Block. Soil, I guess you'd call it soil.
Yeah, that stuff is empty. That stuff is bankrupt. It's not providing enough nutrition for the bulb to turn around and bloom again. So what I would suggest, you repot it. Do you have access to compost?
Yes.
And do you have access to a nice light seed starting mix?
I don't think so. If I do, I use it up.
Okay. What about perlite? The little white.
Perlite I have.
You have perlite.
I love perlite.
Then we're going to go with all compost and perlite. I'd say 75% compost to 25% perlite. And if you're going to err on the side of more perlite. So repot it into that mixture. What kind of water are you using?
Regular tap water.
Oh, deadly.
Yeah,
deadly. Really? They're finally being honest about what's in city water, and it is highly alarming. Luckily, my family doctor, when I was a small child, told me not to drink tap water, to at least boil it first.
Hmm.
But they're being honest now about the stuff that's in it. So the best water is rainwater or melted snow, if you still have any around.
Hmm.
And then if not, and especially if you're drinking water out of the tap, you need some sort of filtration system. You know, even just basic carbon to get some of the stuff out. But the higher end filter you get, the better your water will taste, the healthier your plants will be, not to mention the healthier you'll be. It's a great investment, and it amortizes quickly.
Okay.
So we're changing the mixture, we're changing the water, and now what location do you have this growing plant in?
My father installed a plant window.
Oh.
Which sticks out about a foot, and it has a lower east southern exposure.
Excellent. Excellent. So a true bay window.
Yeah.
Okay. Does it get cold there at night?
It gets chilly, but probably not cold.
Because don't forget, you're growing a tropical plant. I guess you don't have heating mats for seed starting or anything.
I had, but they somehow got disappeared.
Yeah, that happens in my house a lot.
Evil squirrels.
Move the plant as far away from the actual window glass as possible while still giving it as much light as possible. Or keep it in the window during daylight hours and simply move it to a warmer spot in the house at night. And then move it back, and I think your results will be sensational.
When I repot, do I treat it as I would my elephant ear bulb, bare root it for a while, and then put it back in the soil? Or do I repot it when I bring them in and let them sit a few months in the new soil?
Okay, so if you're talking about a bulb that has not sprouted, You pot it as we have described. You give the saucer or the water holder or whatever you've got under it enough clean water until it no longer absorbs any more water. You want to saturate it. Then pour out any excess water and don't water it again until the sprouts appear. And then then begin regular watering.
Okay, but I was talking more about when to repot it.
Well,
as soon as I bring it in?
Well,
or after the dormancy?
The key is to get good green growth over the summer, at least. And then, you know, if you've got good green growth out there in August, there's nothing to stop you from bringing it inside. I wouldn't cut the green leaves off now because they're going to keep moisture in the bulb. But then, yes, you store it in a cool, dark spot for, let's say, 3 months, then bring it out and start the process over again. At that point, you know, you would cut off any brown leaves.
Right. And at that point, is that when I change the soil or was it earlier when I bring it in?
Yeah, I would.
Probably later.
It's such a small amount. I would change the soil every potting.
Okay.
And then toss the excess into your garden or something.
Yep.
All right, man?
Very good.
All right. Good luck to you, sir.
All right. Thank you.
My pleasure. Bye-bye. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and inform everyone out there who's dealing with deep snow not to shovel it onto your lawn or garden if that snow has been exposed to rock salt or even one of the alternative ice melters. But don't go trying to unshovel just yet, because we'll be right back to explain the best soils for filling your raised beds and more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA. What can you expect to hear next week? Hilarity, bad jokes, a small amount of useful information, and me. As long as these bolt cutters keep working. Boy, you know, this station must buy locks by the dozen. I'm Mike McGrath, and that's probably on the next You Bet Your Garden. Maybe. Plus your fabulous phone calls. Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. From the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA, I am your host, Mike McGrath, and we are in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we will reveal the best combination of soils and stuff with which to fill your amazing raised beds that will carry you successfully throughout the summer. But before that, you know, maybe another phone call at 610-694-8100. Sandy, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Sandy. How you doing?
I'm doing really well. And you?
I am just ducky. Thanks for asking. Where are you?
I'm in Villas, New Jersey, which is all the way down on the bay side of Cape May.
I've not been there, but I do see the signs for it. What can we do for Sandy on the bay in Cape May?
Well, we've been having a severe drought down here for quite a while. And last spring, I planted some native plants, a couple of trees, And my husband says he actually planted the trees and some perennials that are native. And I watered them the first year. And I don't normally water things like that the second year if they're native, because I figure they're acclimated. But I'm wondering if I should continue to water them this year if the drought continues.
Okay, so they are one-year plants about to wake up into their second year.
Yes.
How did they do the first year?
They did fine. They don't flourish the first year, but they all had growth, and they were all still looking good when fall came.
Did you watch your husband plant trees?
I did.
And did he take off all the wrappings and plant the trees high in the ground?
They were bare root to begin with, them locally, and I don't remember how he determined how deep to plant them.
Okay. If he planted them deeply while the weather is still cooperating, as soon as the soil thaws, you might want to remove some soil from around the base of the tree. With potted plants that are already filled with dirt, you want like an inch of that dirt to be above of the top of the soil for long-term health of the plant.
Okay.
Now, whenever you plant new trees, watering is important for the first 2 years.
Okay.
It's not just a one-year thing. You know, trees are going to have much more biomass. They got a lot more root growth to get done. A lot of people have watered really sincerely during the first year and then thought, okay, I'm done. But no, you want to follow, because it sounds like you did good, you want to follow the same watering schedule you did the first year, of course, allowing for rain.
Right.
A gardener's best friend is a rain gauge. Do you have one?
I do.
Excellent. So what day of the week do you turn it over and start fresh?
Whenever it rains, I look at how much. We don't get rain more than once a week most of the time.
Right.
So I wait for a rain and see how much we get. And I usually put that down in whatever notes I'm keeping.
Excellent. All right, so you know if you get an inch of rain a week, that should be enough. But your location leads me to believe that you have sandy soil. Do you have full sun exposure?
Yes, and a lot of wind.
Okay, so then you go overboard.
Okay.
Then you go for an inch and a half a week. Unless we have a blazing heat wave where the weather guessers on TV spend half their time apologizing, then it is absolutely okay to go to 2 inches a week, ideally spread out in two long, deep waterings.
Okay.
You know, because it is an investment. It's the first 2 years are building the future strength of your tree. And the same goes for the native shrubs. If they did good the first year, which was kind of a crazy summer, they should do good again the second year. And just make sure that they get, I'm going to say, an inch of water from you or the rain once a week, or an inch and a half if we hit a drought.
Well, we're in a drought now, so should I, when I start watering, if it's still a drought, should I start right in at the heavier amount?
Not really. Until you see new growth on the plants, they're dormant.
Okay.
The roots are not ready to absorb water, but as soon as you see a sign of new growth, that's go time.
Got it. Yeah, that's very helpful, and I will pay very close attention to my rain gauge. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Good luck to you in the future.
Oh, thanks so much. You helped. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right, as promised, it is time for a very important, timely question of the week. What to fill your raised beds with? Bernadette in Allentown writes, I grow vegetables in raised beds. I start with organic plants and grow them organically using certified organic compost as my fertilizer. This year, I have built 4 new raised beds measuring 4 by 8 by 12 inches deep. My question is, what kind of soil should I look for to fill the beds that is as close to organic as possible? I can't use, quote, organic soil in bags. It's too costly for the amount I need. I've heard that mushroom soil is probably treated with chemicals. I would really appreciate your advice on looking for the right soil to fill my raised beds. Well, you should always take the long view here. Raised beds that are constructed and filled correctly at the beginning should be producing excellent harvests for a solid decade or more without any kind of major overhaul. The amount of time you take thinking things through and the amount of money you spend on the contents will amortize over the next decade if you don't rush your decisions or cheap out on those contents. Filling a raised bed correctly is pretty easy. Emptying it and starting all over is not. Now, as I have stated repeatedly, there really isn't anything you can buy in a bag or bulk called, quote, organic soil. However, bagged potting soils, composts, and the like that carry the OMRI seal of approval, that's OMRI for Organic Materials Research Institute, have been tested and approved for use on organic farms and, of course, gardens. I never recommend compost alone when filling a bed for the first time. It can get too heavy, especially in wet climates. For me, the perfect mix is around 40% compost, 40% high-quality screened topsoil, and a generous 20% perlite. Perlite is a mined volcanic mineral that aids drainage and retains water, which is quite a trip. Don't be tempted to use any of your old garden soil. In addition to weed seeds, pests, and pathogens like verticillium wilt, it could contain lead, an especially common problem in urban areas and anywhere near an older home, garage, roadway, railroad line, service station, etc. And the danger is to you, not to your plants. Lead-contaminated soil can be extremely harmful to anyone touching or even inhaling the dust. And besides, that old garden soil of yours is what you're escaping, not running towards. Before you buy topsoil or compost in bulk, go to the facility and get a bucket full of each to test. Place some of the topsoil in 2 regular plant pots. Same with the compost. Leave the first pot of each unplanted, but water it frequently. Sow some fresh seeds in the other ones. Pea or bean seeds are the best indicators of herbicide poisoning, which is what we're testing for here. Cover these pots with the seeds in them with a little bit more soil, water well, and then stretch clear plastic wrap over the top. Water as necessary to keep the soil moist. And do this indoors to keep the seeds warm enough to germinate promptly. If the empty pots stay empty after 10 days or so, the material should be weed-free. If the empty pots stay empty after 10 days or so, the material should be weed-free. If those empty pots sprout plants, the material contains weed seeds. If your test crop plants come up looking nice and green and happy and healthy, the material they grow in should be clean. If they emerge all withered, nasty looking, that's a sign that there's herbicide in that there dirt. You should perform this test on every load of bulk material you're thinking about purchasing. Do not order it and wait until it gets dropped off. Once that material hits your driveway, you're stuck with it. In addition, give every batch what we call the duck test again before you buy. Pick up a handful. Does it smell like good, rich soil? Does it feel like good, rich soil? And does it look like good, rich soil? If it smells like a duck, looks like a duck, and feels like a duck, it's just ducky. However, if that material has any off odors, feels slimy, or is soaking wet or crumbly dry, take a pass. It's not going to get any better. Start this quest early so you can take samples in a number of different garden centers. If they are reluctant to give you material for testing, offer them a couple of bucks for a couple of bucket loads and tell them your driveway is not yet quite finished enough to receive a big load, but that you need some starter material for putting up winter hardy plants. Or you can choose the credible lie of your choice. There are numerous facilities all over the country that sell bulk compost, bulk topsoil, and mixes of each. Municipalities and larger garden centers should be able to supply you with the equivalent of a professional soil test for bulk compost. So always ask for the paper. But no matter what that paper says, you should still take home a sample of any bulk material for testing before you buy. Oh, mushroom soil. There are at least four different kinds. Fresh and aged regular mushroom soil and fresh and aged organic mushroom soil. The differences are important, and we'll take another question of the week to explain, which we plan to do when you join us again. Same bat time, same bat channel. Well, that was hopefully some helpful advice about filling your raised beds with good stuff, now wasn't it? To delve into the details at your leisure or your leisure, you can read the information over at the Gardens Alive section of the Gurney's website. Yikes! My producer is threatening to bust up my beds if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 610-694-8100, extension number 3. Or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse, teeming to our garden shore at our new email site, youbetyourgarden1@gmail.com. Either way, please, please, please include your location, and if you're an especially nice person, your phone number. You'll find that new phone number, that new email address, a link to the ever-growing Gardens Alive archive of previous answers, and new and improved links to our podcast site. It's all at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. You Bet Your Garden is a public radio show and podcast produced and delivered to you every week from the studios of NPR station WDIY in Bethlehem, PA. You Bet Your Garden was created by Mike McGrath. Mike McGrath was created by Lerner and Lowe with choreography by Jerome Robbins. Our musical director is Ken Queer. Our social media director is Amanda Norfleet. Our peerless prince of profound production is James Ziproat. Margaret McConnell is the executive director of WDIY-FM. Our executive producer is the always lovely Jonas Bowen. And our incredible assistant is the awesome Ninja Sean. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. And sadly, my continuing recovery from pneumonia will likely keep me away from the Philadelphia Flower Show this year. But I'll be enjoying it through your eyes and emails and photos. Hint, hint, hint. Until I can see you again next week. Yeah.